As, this is the more familiar theory, the synagogue grew up during the days of the Babylonian exile. In the 6th century before the Common Era, when the Judeans were forcibly ejected from their land, taken into exile, the temple was destroyed and they had to recreate a faith de novo, new, out of nothing. The habit must have grown up slowly in the days of the exile for the Judeans to come together around their priests or around their prophets, to sit at their feet, to read together from the Torah, from the Holy Law. And from that reading of Scripture, which remains the central element of our worship to this day, from that informal reading and discussion of the meaning of our faith, the synagogue began. The second conjecture dealing with the origin of the synagogue derives it from an institution known as the Ma'amadot. This was an institution which existed in the early days of the First Commonwealth, in the 7th and 6th centuries before the Common Era, which was to this effect, that every community was required to send to Jerusalem twice a year delegates who brought with them sacrifices and who attended the sacrifices when they were offered in the temple. And that the custom grew up that when the delegates left their hometown for Jerusalem, at the very moment when the hometown's sacrifices were being offered on the holy altar, the townsmen and townswomen would draw together in the central square or in some place and would recite the very same psalms, the very same hymns which were being sung by their delegates and by the priests in Jerusalem. We cannot prove either theory. Whichever one we accept, or whatever conjecture we make, the institution of the synagogue is 2,500 years or more ancient. And over those 25 centuries, this institution has been the cradle of our faith. And through these centuries, the synagogue has grown and changed again. What I'd like to do then this morning is to look at the present version of the synagogue we know, this place and all that are similar to it, and to look ahead and to wonder what the synagogue may be like a decade or two from now. Because of this I am certain, that we live in changing times and that the synagogue will have to change with the times. Now this perspective was brought into focus for me by a necessity which was mine yesterday. Temple Emmanuel in New York City had its 125th anniversary. Temple Emmanuel is something of the Cadillac among Jewish congregations. It's very beautiful, it's very big, it's very affluent. It's very old-fashioned. And I bethought myself that I would speak at these dedication services to which I was invited to be the speaker on the future of the synagogue. It would give me an opportunity to think of the synagogue as an institution rather than of us, to think of the general trend of the times rather than of the specific needs and changes which we are going through, and that this kind of thinking might be useful to all of us this morning. So allow me to share with you now some of the thoughts that I expressed yesterday and then change these thoughts and apply them more immediately to us today. First thing that I said to this congregation yesterday was simply this, that no amount of institutional change can guarantee the success of the Jewish religious enterprise unless people want it to succeed. There is no such thing as the delegation of faith to an institution. You can belong to a great temple such as ours and have a merry, mediocre, or mild faith. Simply by registering on some congregational rolls, you do not become a good Jew. Faith cannot be handed down and must be won. It must be struggled for. It's a personal commitment. The first step is yours. You must volunteer to take part in the Jewish communal and Jewish religious enterprise. Judaism has never believed in vicariousness in matters of faith. And no institution is a substitute for one's personal faith. Now, I say this because I think there are many who define Judaism today as belonging to a synagogue. And by that, they mean simply this. I've paid the membership dues. I send my child to the religious school. My daughter's wedding was solemnized by the rabbi, and I attend occasionally on the high holidays. Those who so define Jewish religious life, and I'm afraid that they are many, are terribly frustrated by it because it's not satisfying. It's bland. It's relatively meaningless. It's superficial to their lives. It's something which occurs occasionally but is not at the very heart of things. And they find that they're not very much changed by this membership, this kind of superficial membership. And they wonder. Now, it's too bad. It's too bad that this is the definition of Jewishness or faith for so many, because never before, I think, in recent history at least, have the balanced theological judgments of Judaism and the high spiritual and ethical disciplines of Judaism been more urgently needed. However else we may define our age, it's a convulsive time. It's an age full of change. It's an age where we have more than perhaps people have ever had before. More opportunity, more freedom, and more nervous breakdowns, and more young people wandering around with bland, bleak, sullen, dead looks on their faces. What is required of us in 1970? By whom? Is there a new morality? What is the new morality? What is the way that we should go? How will we achieve substantially? How will we achieve peace of mind and happiness? All of us are confused by these questions. What was once so certain a decade ago, a generation ago, is no longer certain. The standards by which we guide our lives are no longer self-evident. All of us are questioning. All of us are wondering. All of us find ourselves changing direction. What is demanded of us and by whom? That's precisely what a synagogue exists to help us understand. That is precisely the business of faith, to help us to come to some answer to the questions of value and of meaning. But many of us, I'm afraid, live only on the surface of things. He was young, in an open shirt, beads around his neck. He was unshod. He spoke to me with a smile in his eye and in that deliberately soft voice which so many young people are cultivating. And he said, you know, I'm not the person who's dropped out. My parents have. It's not that they don't know, they're not even asking the questions anymore. They read what everybody else is reading. They say what everybody else is saying. They go to see or to be seen. They go to synagogue when everybody else is dressing up. They've ceased to feel, to care, to be concerned. It's just a matter somehow of getting through every day, somehow getting by. And that's not what life is all about. And how right he was. Never in Scripture is it said, join a congregation and gain a faith. But again and again in Scripture we read, Darshuni v'yichyu, seek ye me and live. How can we seek God? By searching for him. By admitting the shadows and the sunshine of life, the anguish and the love, the fear and the hope, all the confusion. By facing it honestly and by seeking the meaning which somehow is implicit in it. We call ourselves the children of Israel. How do we get the name? Israel, of course, is the other name of Jacob, our father. The name he gained by wrestling the long night with himself, with his conscience, with his whole life, and by not being overcome. And if we want to be children of Israel, then that's what's before us. To accept life in its rawness, to accept reality with all its confusion, all its quixotic nature, and not to assume that life is other than it really is. Serious, brutal, sometimes cruel, always short, always demanding, demanding of us, demanding of the faith which sustains us. The first step in any reconstruction of the American synagogue is a step that each member of a synagogue must take. It's a statement, I'm seeking. I want to understand. I need to know. It's the humility which says no longer, I know it all. I have a political ideology which defends and defines everything. I am sophisticated. I have nothing to learn. It's the statement, I have everything to learn. I need to know how to feel, how to be passionate, how to be concerned, how to be involved. What are the standards which must be my standards? I'm willing to come, to be exposed, and to listen. But having said all of that, what happens when the serious and the sensitive do come? Is the modern American synagogue prepared to be supportive of them in their search, in our search for faith? How much of what happens in the ordinary American synagogue must be classified under the rubric spinning of wheels, formal rather than effective, the genteel word rather than the living word? How much of what happens within a synagogue is tangential to this ultimate religious enterprise? How much of it do we undertake simply because it's the way in which things were done yesterday and the day before? When I thought how I might develop this point, I was reminded of an early Reform prayer book. It was written and edited in the middle of the 19th century. It's a rather interesting prayer book. But I cite it not to you because I want to engage in any kind of talk of the reform of liturgy. But simply because this particular prayer book, edited by a man named Leo Merzbacher, contained with it an explanation of the text, the standards which had led him to select certain points, certain paragraphs, and to scissor out others. And he tried to explain to those who came into his synagogue what this prayer book, which was placed in their hands, was intended to do. I often regret that our union prayer book doesn't include such an explanation. It would be helpful. But what particularly appealed to me in this particular prayer book introduction were a few lines which he addressed not specifically to the reader who came to worship, but to the Jew who would not accept the changes, the sincerity of this religious liturgical reform. Merzbacher wrote this: "Lay aside the prayer book with a smile if you please, or with scorn if you choose. Be only kind enough to give us some credit for sincerity. How different soever these ideas may be from yours, or our ways from your ways, be reminded of the saying of the sages, Kol machloket shehi l'shem shamayim sofa litkayem, every discord which has a holy purpose tends in the end to a consolidation." Now in the event, these early reforms have become commonplace. And in the event, the Jewish community has become accustomed to liturgical variety. But also in the event, we, the descendants of these original spiritual rebels, have become the religious establishment. And what I'd like to suggest, what I suggested yesterday, what I would suggest again today, is that many of us refuse to give credence to the sincerity of those who criticize, with those who say to us, you're hidebound, you're moribund. You're doing things simply because they're customary, things which are no longer vital, meaningful to many. And that's the proposition I'd like to examine, because it seems to me that there's truth in this complaint. There's a tendency, in particularly in the Reformed synagogue, to assume that that which was successful, that which was reforming a generation ago, is still that which is successful and that which is meaningful today. Reformed, dear friends, was an outgrowth of those Jews in the 19th century who were unwilling to leave Judaism, who felt there was greatness here and meaning, but who found that they no longer could be constrained within the rich parochial Jewish life of the shtetl, who sought to cut away the underbrush so that the tall trees, the central themes of Judaism, could grow higher and the shade of their branches should cover them ever more effectively. Reform was a creation of those who believed, those who wished to renew the strength of the ancient faith, who knew that the synagogue, the institution, is only the envelope which in each generation tries to address the ancient, priceless, ageless, unchangeable, simple message of Judaism in terms which the reader, the recipient, can understand. It's well to remember that Moses did not receive the Union Prayer Book from God at Mount Sinai, that Aaron did not dictate to the children of Israel their religious school curriculum, which was to be fixed and single and to remain central in all Jewish schools for all ages. Moses even had the good fortune never to meet a rabbi. What he had were the commandments, the mitzvot. And what every generation of Jews has had is the responsibility of taking these commandments and translating them into terms which you and I, those who are alive, the last chain in the link, can understand and can make effective in our lives. And the minute we become bound to institutional forms, we're restricted by the past. And what was effective yesterday is not necessarily effective today. So let's ask ourselves, what is the real purpose of a synagogue? Why does a synagogue exist? And the answer I would suggest to you is that a synagogue exists in order to support anyone who seeks the ultimate religious virtue. And what is that virtue? Kedusha, holiness. Holy shalt thou be, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And what is holiness? Judaism has a particular definition of kedusha. Holiness is not, in our tradition, an exuberant pietism, midnight vigils and fastings and lacerations of the flesh. Holiness is not immuring ourselves, walling ourselves in from life to live a life which is one purely of worship and of prayer. Holiness is a spiritual discipline and a moral self-discipline. It's an understanding of the ethical commandments and an understanding and insight into what is significant in life and what is trivial, tinsel, trash. Kedusha. Throughout the communities of Israel, the synagogues these last weeks, we've been reading from the third book of the Bible, the book of Leviticus. Sefer Kedoshim, the book which describes that which is holy. And how does Leviticus describe holiness? Simply this way. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Honor thy father and thy mother. Revere the Lord thy God. Remove the stumbling block from before the blind. Do not bear a grudge. Do not seek vengeance. Speak truth and never falsely. Kedusha is a sanctified way of life, sanctified by the ethical quality of that life, sanctified by the understanding, the insight which the individual brings to life. And that's Kedusha, as we Jews define it. And all that takes place in a synagogue should be conducive to making us understand the better how we can become kadosh, holy. Why do we have worship every day, every week? Because in our lives, the humdrum, the routine, the base, the vulgar might easily move us away from our concerns with Kedusha if daily, if weekly, we didn't have a moment where we breathed again its air, where we touched again its beauty, where we sensed again the goal and direction of our lives. And why is there Torah, the moral learning and instruction in a synagogue? So that we can take these basic elemental truths and somehow understand how they fit into the complexity of our lives. For what is said simply can be applied only with understanding and with conviction. And why is there a congregation? Because holiness is not something we can achieve by ourselves. We need the cooperation of loved ones. We need the cooperation of family. To bring holiness into our community, we need the cooperation and the understanding and the support of many. Worship, study, congregation. These are the traditional terms of a synagogue life, because they're each and every one of them is significant in helping us to achieve Kedusha, holiness. Does the modern synagogue really help us along the way? The proper words are spoken. There is beauty to our rite. There are discussions of moral values in our religious schools. But somehow, we're not touching the raw flesh. Somehow, when all is said and done, there's too much which is peripheral, which doesn't reach to the heart of things, which doesn't touch our soul. The most damning thing you can say about the contemporary synagogue is that we're not relevant enough so that the young people have taken to demonstrating against us. We just haven't been that significant. We haven't talked in ways where they find no argument with what we say. It's genteel, it's generous, it's great-hearted. But they know it's somehow not of the very stuff of life today. It's not part of the cutting edge. What's needed? I would suggest that what's needed is a reform of reform. And by that I don't mean another going through of the prayer book to see whether every line is one which is theologically accepted. The test of worship is no longer its theological pristineness, but is it alive? Does it touch me? Does it change me? Is it warm? The criticism is that it is too cold and mechanical, not that there is some theological fault with it. And I would submit to you that what is needed today is not another theological apologetic for Judaism, which shows that the Jewish tradition is congruent with the latest wrinkle in scientific philosophy. The proof of faith today is not its logic, but is it alive? Does it change people? Does it move people to act other than they would have acted otherwise? What does it do for me? Not is it sweetly reasonable, but is it effective? Is there a catalyst to a change within my inner being? What we need is a synagogue which is less one-dimensional than our synagogues have been this last 100 years. Compare the synagogue of Europe 100 years ago with our synagogues. A little room used in the morning for the study of Talmud, used 3 times a day for public worship. Occasionally there'd be great brawls in the synagogue room over some shtetl policy. It was a center of communal life. It was a place of learning. It was a place of simple worship. We live in a new age. The synagogue had to expand to meet the new needs of the new age. We were now the entire community. The shtetl was self-enclosed and parochial. Now suddenly we were part of the larger world. And we needed to know how to relate to that world. We sought desperately to understand our faith in its terms. We sought to bring its aesthetics, its music, its beauty into the synagogue. We sought to explain our faith as much to others outside the synagogue walls as to ourselves. We sought to make ourselves burger, bourgeois, respected and respectable. And above all, since the 19th century was the age of humanism and of emancipation, and of optimism. We sought to be reasonable and sweet and understanding in all that we said and did. But you and I live after Auschwitz, and you and I live after Hiroshima, and you and I live after Watts. Confidence has been bled from our life. We're no longer optimistic. We know that hate is not easily eradicated. We know that sweet reason by itself does not change the ways in which men govern their lives or bring justice into a society. Our life is far more shadowy, far darker in its corners than was life 100 years ago. Values are not as clear. And we talk to people who speak from a variety of experiences and not from a single experience. We talk of a generation gap. We who are the older talk in terms of one frame of reference. Our youth talks in another frame of reference. But there are other gaps besides the generation gap. There's the gap of experience. The gap between those whose experience has been largely academic and those whose experience was to learn how to live the hard way by making it themselves. There's the gap between those who speak the language of the street and those who speak the language of polite society. There's the gap between those who were trained in the canons of classical art and music and those who have been conditioned by the cacophonous noises which pass for music. I'm showing my prejudices among so many today. And the synagogue must find ways to speak with a variety of voices its single message. It must first learn to listen. It must learn what questions are being asked. I often have the feeling that we are answering questions which are not being asked. We are answering questions which were asked a generation or two ago. We really haven't listened to what is being demanded of us. Or we're being asked to provide understanding and support to a degree which was not true a generation or so. People today need to know why they're alive. Is there hope? Is there any reason to hold on to their dignity? A generation ago, they were asking very simply, tell me how I can enlarge the ambit, the circumference of my effectiveness. Tell me how I can be a better citizen. Today, they're asking, why should I be a citizen? Is this world purely chaotic? It seems to be. Show me the pattern. Show me the direction. Show me the hope. People are bringing today to faith a far more desperate thirst than they brought a generation or more ago. And we have to be prepared to provide the sustaining milk and ambrosia. And I wonder sometimes if we are. What will the synagogue be like a generation from now? In the first instance, the synagogues which will survive will be places where many more will speak and be heard. The groups will be smaller. The contacts will be more intimate. It will be a place in which people will come and rub elbows, not passing in the doorway with people they barely can name, but where the groups which they find within the synagogue will be groups of people with whom they can relate as eyes to thous, as people to people. Paradoxically, I believe the synagogues will be larger, but the groups within the synagogue will have multiplied and will be more intimate. Economics will determine the size of the synagogue. Psychology will determine the size of the groups within it. Because the one thing you and I must learn above all else is how to be human. And we can learn that only as we share spirit, relationship, feeling with other human beings. And that means that we come here to have contact with people, with feeling, beyond the narrow nuclear family of which we're a part. We come here for friendship and the support that friendship brings. We come here for learning, to share experience and insight. We come here to meet with those whose life experience is similar to ours and those whose life experience is different from ours. And the synagogue will have to provide a variety of groupings, a variety of opportunities for this meeting and for this exchange. And I would believe that in our worship in the decade that lies ahead, we will find that we are turning more and more to ourselves to draw out of ourselves our needs, our hopes, and our expressions. We'll turn more and more towards a kind of feeling in faith, a warmth, a touching, a movement. There'll be, I believe, more dance, there'll be more singing, there'll be more movement, less sitting, less of concern with decorum and quiet, and more with awareness, more with sensitivity, more with congregation. It will not be easy. The changes will demand a certain flexibility of spirit of all of us. It's easy to become familiar and happy with accustomed ways. But the changes are looming on the horizon. Jewish life will, I think, be the stronger for it. For of this I am confident, that men and women, particularly the young, are turning to faith with a greater sense of urgency than they have in many a decade. In university after university, tens of hundreds of young Jews turned to courses in Oriental mysticism this last year or so. Why? Because they didn't find enough life, enough warmth, enough depth in the worship that had been presented to them in their synagogues. That's the negative. The positive is they felt the need for this quiet. They felt the need for this warmth. They felt the need for the experience of worship. And what's true of worship and true of meeting is true of learning. We're going to have to research our tradition so that we draw from it the insights which deal with the confusions of our day, which tell us not so much what is right politically or what is necessary economically. Those must be said also. The insights which go beyond these to what is needed personally by each of us, in order somehow to live out each day and to find each day full of grace and meaning. And finally, we're going to turn to the synagogue more and more for support of our identity as Jews, because that identity will be threatened again in the decades that lie ahead. It is threatened in the Soviet Union, it is threatened in the Middle East. If times remain as uncertain as they are in the United States, it will be threatened increasingly here. And we will turn to the synagogue for support, for encouragement, for the grace which inspirits life, for that which Jews have always found in their synagogues and all the places of their habitations. It's going to be an interesting decade for all of us. This congregation this year completes its 120th year of existence. Jews for decades have said to each other, Ad Me'av Esrim, on every birthday, may you live to be 120. But we've got there. Now what? I'm not sure whether or not we believe in resurrection. I am sure that we believe in change and continuity. And these are going to be the terms of life for us in the next 20 years. I dare not say 120. They're going to be changeful years, revolutionary years, exciting years, years in which what we do is urgently needed, and if we don't do it, we and our young people will turn increasingly to other fountains of so-called insight, other ideologies for their support. I'd far rather have them turn here. But what we have to teach is humane, what we have to teach is noble, and what we have to teach is full of love and not of hate, full of dignity and not of indecency, full of respect for man and for one's fellow man. We set nothing but God above the human spirit. Amen.